Welcome to the Spark Girls podcast, the self-publishing podcast for authors. You're in the right place for the best writing, marketing, and publishing advice, plus interviews with industry experts and best-selling authors. I'm Cheryl Phipps.
I'm Shah Barrett.
I'm Wendy Vella.
And I'm Trudy J. And this week we have Claire Taylor.
Woohoo!
Welcome, Claire.
And just so you know, so Claire was the host of the Sell More Books show for a wee while, and she is also an awesome author in her own right and also teaches other authors how to be awesome authors. Did I say that round the right way?
Yeah.
Yes, lovely. But just to clarify, she's not the English cricketer.
Yes. Just okay. In case anyone just was worried.
A few people are looking for her.
Anyway, sorry, Claire. So I'm going to read out your bio, and then we're going to get right into the interview, and then you can do all the talking and we will be quiet. So Claire Taylor is a story-obsessed indie author with more than 24 books published under various pen names, who loves to help authors become more aligned in their careers. Through her company, FFS Media, she publishes her own fiction and helps other indie authors through her story alignment and author alignment services, as well as her masterclasses and nonfiction for authors. Claire uses the Enneagram framework to help authors create careers they love and stories that stand out. Welcome.
Welcome, Claire.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. So that's awesome. So the Enneagram is like a personality test. Am I right about that? And that you've kind of extended out to kind of, or extrapolated out to kind of help authors figure out their career and also their writing? Is that just...
There are tests for the Enneagram, but the Enneagram is a personality framework that defines 9 different lenses on the world. So these are based off of core fears and desires. And that's, so it's a motivational personality profile. Yeah. And yeah, there are all different kinds of tests you can take on it. And very few of them have real accuracy because it's more of a self-development process of figuring out how you've been viewing the world and the water you've been swimming in without realizing it.
Yeah, no, that's cool. That's good. So I just wanted to explain that first before we go any further. So, but first of all, before we even get that far, what I'd really love you to do is just explain how you got into writing and self-publishing and just give us your origin story so we know.
Oh, boy. I hope it's not a villain origin story. We will see.
We will see.
Some story arc left to this.
That would be more interesting. Could you just turn it into
it would be. So I have just been writing since I was really young. I think I joined my first writing club or something when I was like 10 and just kept going. So I always enjoy the storytelling, the sort of fantasy, the making things up. In an acceptable way where I wouldn't get in trouble. And then eventually I decided to study it in college. And so that did a pretty good job of completely stomping the passion out of me for writing for a good few years. Because all of the stuff that I wanted to write, that I loved writing, was really frowned upon in the, collegiate setting. And so I did learn a lot of skills doing that, but then I had to relearn my passion for it. So I kept writing, I kept at it. I liked to write humor, and that was really frowned upon, but I did it anyway because it was kind of my little fun, rebellious thing. Well, I could still be a good girl in real life, but then I would write this really, irreverent humor. And so that was very fulfilling to me. And then I worked as an in-house editor for a while after I graduated, and then I taught English and tutored it for a while. And then eventually I just decided it's time to take the plunge. And one of my friends introduced me to indie publishing. This was back in 2014, I think. And so I was like, oh, this is an option. You're telling me that I can write what I want and I can just publish it and I can just be in control of the whole process. I love it. I'm in. So I started publishing my own stuff, and I traded off. My friend who introduced me was also an editor, and so we traded off editing each other's stuff since I had that background as well. And the rest is history. She's still my editor. So So it's great. So that's what
write?
I did. I started I started writing humor. Actually, no, let me back up. I did start publishing erotica when I was, it's a very erotic romance. My editing experience was in romance. So I did hundreds of romance manuscripts. So it was very familiar to me. It was very fun to kind of be able to write what I liked in that rather than just whatever was thrown at me. Yeah. So I did that for a while. And then it was something I could do, but it wasn't really the thing that I wanted to be doing. So what I wanted to be doing was writing more humor. So I started writing humor and satire and started publishing that in, I think 2016 was when I started really going hard with that. And then I eventually branched into other things. I wanted to write some, you know, paranormal cop comedies. So I did that for a while and went back and forth between that. And then I eventually added in a paranormal cozy mystery because I've always been a huge mystery fan. I like the cerebral like weaving of it. So I did some paranormal cozy mystery. And then, you know, I did that for a while and that was really good. And I burned myself out on it. Of course, you know, we all do at some point because we're like, this is great. I bet if I did it a bunch more and much harder, it would be even better.
So true.
And then apparently that's not the formula. So yeah, so I burned out on that. And then I started writing some crime fiction. I really enjoyed that kind of gritty detective crime fiction, serial killers. I had to productively use all of my true crime consumption somehow. I had to justify the searches, really. I had to justify the Google searches somehow. That's just what I've been writing. And then, you know, in the meantime, I got into all this Enneagram stuff for my own writing. And then started helping other people with it for their writing. And then people were like, oh, if this works for characters, does this work for people? And I'm like, why, yes, it does. And then started doing some of this Enneagram, you know, like coaching with the career and got all my certifications and stuff. And so the rest is history.
Wow.
You're a busy girl.
Yes.
So are you writing regularly in each of those genres or have you sort of just picked one?
Sort of. I have to be realistic about it this year because I'm taking a break. I'm just writing in paranormal cozy mystery and then my nonfiction. But I have at least one more book left of my space comedy series, the Alice Lux Space Adventures, that I'll do next year. That's on the dock for next year. And then, yeah, I intend to get back into the paranormal police comedy because it's so fun. Gangs and like,
oh my God,
the shifters and all kinds of stuff. So yeah, we've got fun stuff
sounds
in that.
Awesome. I love that. Awesome. Okay. So let's start talking a little bit about the Enneagram. So you explained what it is that you're using it as is the term personality test the wrong thing to say? Like, is that kind of,
I would say it's not a test. It's really based around like a framework. And then there are some people will offer tests to help you sort of jump the line and figuring out what your type is.
Yeah. So how do you start out with it? Like when you're trying to explain someone, why is it relevant for us to use maybe in our career or as figuring things out? Let's start there before talking about it in our books.
Right. So especially if you're just starting out in this, there are so many decisions you have to make. And if you don't know how to make them, that they align with your motivation, then you're very easily influenced into these sort of dead ends that just don't work for you because it worked for someone else. And I just want to have the success, you know, the results that they're having. So I'm just going to try and do this. So it really helps you get to know what is going on and recognize your patterns of thinking, feeling, and behaving that you have not seen before. We all have these patterns of thinking, feeling, and behaving. And we are almost guaranteed to continue in those patterns until we pause and learn to recognize them. And those patterns may not be the healthiest. They tend to be patterns of, you know, thought patterns, emotional patterns, and sort of reactive behavioral patterns that we picked up very early on in life. And we will just continue doing them. Sometimes they're described as this armor that we put on to protect ourselves. But as we grow, the armor becomes too restrictive. And so learning about your core fear and your core desire, which is what defines the type, helps you understand what you're trying to avoid in your split second decisions and what you're secretly craving and maybe not the most productive, fulfilling sense, and how that is skewing you one way or another and making you, you know, pick the same options over and over again so that you keep getting the same results, even if you don't like the results.
Yeah.
So it's really about sort of bringing that mindfulness. It's a big mindfulness tool to bring that mindfulness and understand why you're doing the things you're doing, so that it helps a lot, especially early on, because then you're not just sold on all of these dreams that are not realistic, which I think we've all seen people selling unrealistic dreams in this industry.
Oh, yeah.
So, yes. So when you become more aware that there's no silver bullet and you understand how much and how deeply you're craving a silver bullet to come save you, then you can start to sort of, you know, take back the power and make the right decisions for you.
Mm-hmm. We see that a lot, actually, people looking for a silver bullet, like the magic pill, the one thing. And a lot of people just, when they're talking to us, say, you know, it's almost like they want us just to tell them the one thing they need to do that will make them successful, like all the people they see. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. And I do really think, like you're talking about with the Enneagram, that it's different for different people and you have to take your own path and it'll be different. Yeah, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that it includes fear, like what you're, because that's not something that they, well, maybe, I mean, I just, it's quite openly a part of what you're doing when you're figuring this out. How do you, why do you think that's in there? Is that a important part of it?
Well, here's how it works. We have these core fears. So each person has a different core fear. And these core fears are things like being bad or corrupt, or being worthless or valueless, or being trapped in deprivation, right? So those are some examples of these. Mm. And at that is at our core functioning. And then our attention is going to, like, this is our subconscious filtering. It's called the perceptual filter. It filters out anything like options that at all attack our core fear. We say, no, we're not doing that. We defend against it. It flares up this core fear. And so an example might be if you are what's called a type 8, the challenger, it's frequently called the challenger. This is all about the fear of being harmed and controlled. And so what happens is we are oversensitive to anything that feels like that when we start out doing this work. So an offer of help from someone, an unsolicited offer of help, may feel to an 8 like an attempt to control them because they're oversensitive to it. And it could just be a reader being like, hey, I have like this person who I think you should meet. They work in Hollywood. And you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. If you're an 8, you're like, why? Why are you offering this? What are you trying to get from me? How are you trying to control me and like force this reciprocation? And they might be, say, a 2 who is the helper. And they just want to be worthy of love and earn love. And they love helping people. So it would actually just make them feel good if they could help. They're not trying to control you, right? So when we have careers that are, you know, we like to think of ourselves as sort of these isolated authors, but our career is this big web, as y'all know. I mean, the four of you working together, you know? Mm-hmm. But we have to become aware of what we're oversensitive to, because we're probably ruling out a bunch of really good options without even realizing it. Because this is like very primal level of like, no, we're not doing that. But when we can bring it into our conscious mind through the like pausing between stimulus and response, then we can really start to examine it through the lens that we have of going, okay, well, I know that I'm an 8 and that I'm a little bit sensitive to people trying to harm and control me. Is this someone trying to harm and control me? Well, from what I know about them, that doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem like maybe they just genuinely want to help, right? And now you could accept this offer. Who knows what that's going to open up in your life, right? So we can start to, these are the patterns, the knee-jerk patterns that are functioning in the background, these scripts that are really limiting us. So a lot of people are afraid of the Enneagram because they think it's going to put them in a box. But what it does is it takes you out of the box you've put yourself in. Yeah. And so it's a liberation tool. It's not defining and diminishing and labeling you and, you know, being able to be like, oh, you're such a 5 or anything like that, right? It's about,
I'm constantly being told I'm a 5. I mean,
yeah. So it's really about like just giving you more options. And so as an author, we constantly need new options because when the industry changes, the things that work stop working. And so we need to be able to see other things.
Okay. It's a brilliant explanation and a very reassuring one, because I think
a different way of looking at it, to be
fair. Yeah, I like that.
It's interesting because it's making you think, right? Like instead of just
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. I
know, right? But like, instead
what were you thinking?
Reactive,
really
reactive to stuff. Oh my god, yeah. It's like having another Wendy.
Yeah,
it's like as soon as something like this comes along, I'll just go no.
Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of it is that fear of being judged. Yeah. And I hear a lot of that with a lot of the other things that people are talking about a lot, not to mention any names, because it does feel like a judgment, you know, whether it's intended or not. And I guess that's another thing too, is how we hear what people are saying.
Yeah.
Just sort of the challenger. Mm-hmm. Yes, I got that quite
right. Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. When I first was exposed to the Enneagram, it was actually years before I started becoming interested in it. It was my mom and my sister had taken like a workshop on it and come back and typed me. And it turns out they were wrong. But it was, for me, it was a little bit of like a, oh, you're such a this. Oh, you're definitely a this. Yes. And it was, you're definitely a this because, and then they would list off kind of these like negative qualities. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't think I like this. So like a bunch of people's first exposure to the Enneagram is similar. And then they're like, oh, this is going to be another thing that people use to like label me, dismiss me, you know, and that's just it really unfortunate because what it's not for other people. It's for you. It's for you to liberate yourself and for you to, yes, there is part of it where you have to confront your negative tendencies and these harmful qualities that you haven't seen yourself doing. You know, you meant the best, but you're causing some harm. And so it's time to confront that. Mm-hmm. And so that's like the shadow work and that sort of thing that can be done with this. But for the most part, it's a really nice roadmap to see what does healthy, you know, what do healthy patterns look like for you? Because a lot of us don't know.
Mm. And I think, without being, you don't have to be judgy about using it though on other people. I think that like you, in the example you gave before, is someone who's an eight, who's wary of other people helping, comes up against a two who is just someone who loves to help for the sake of helping. It helps them to know that there are other people and other ways of thinking out there. Like
Absolutely.
Yeah.
People do have different motivations from us. And we tend not to see that. Before we do this work, we tend to just be puzzled when people don't act the way we would act. Mm-hmm. Because we're like, why? What is this person doing? Like, this is so unhinged. Why would they do that? Like, are they out of their mind? Right. And then you start to realize, oh, I understand why they're doing it. They're doing it differently. If I did that action, it would be done from a different place. Yeah. But they are doing this action from a much different motivation that I am comfortable with them, having.
So if you think about it that way, it can allow you to become more tolerant rather than more judgy in some ways.
I think when scared of something too, right, we just close ourselves off and judge. Like a change, anything like that, eh? We just sort of go, no.
You're such an what is that? Mindy.
Like, yeah, what are these two crazy people that are in the spa girls with me talking about? You know, not pointing fingers at anyone.
And Shara or Rudy or anything.
Yeah, you know, like when they start, I'm just like, no, not interested. Maybe but it's actually fear of
your explanation is quite refreshing. Because it sounds like it could open more possibilities rather than, as you say, putting yourself in a box or other people putting you in their box. But I wonder how it works for if you are more, and I guess we're all of these things in different proportions. So how does it feel if, say, maybe two of them are equally distributed in your personality but are actually warring against each other?
Right. So the good thing is that they're asking for a friend.
She's asking for me and I'm asking for her. So that's how this works.
Yeah. So there are, you know, thankfully we are one type. One type will win out, right? So if there's two that are very high, like I'm very high in eight, I'm also very high in one. I test very high in those. I can relate to both of them. But if I have to choose between a situation that where I need to do the right thing, which is the motivation of the one, or the thing that will give me more power, which is the position of the eight, I'm going to choose the right thing, even if that means that I'm in a power down position because of it. And so you can kind of square off your two top motivations and think about times in your life where you had to choose between those things. Mm-hmm. And that can help you figure out your core motivation or your main type, your dominant type, and what that core motivation for you is. And that once you hit on it. Sometimes it could take a while. It can take years. Some people get it wrong for a while, and there are all kinds of interesting reasons for why that might happen. It's not just like that person sucks. You know, it's like there's all kinds of influences that we have.
It might be that they suck.
I mean, between us, it might be, but it could also be other things.
Yeah. I'm not judging.
Once you figure it out, your past kind of clicks into place and you're like, ah, I see why I did all of these things that led me here. And then the great news is your type doesn't change. So you just know what work you have to do, and you can give up trying to be those other types and trying to like function like them. Mm. And you just get to like thrive at your optimal functioning, you know, like what's healthy for you, and move into your gifts.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
And do these gifts change as time goes on? Do you become more or less of one than the other? Is that a thing, or is it, will you always be innate?
So you'll always be your dominant type, but you're right. You do have all nine types in you in sort of varying degrees. So it's kind of the system that you have going on. And then there are going to be situations that come up in life where you kind of have to unpack some of the baggage and the patterns around a particular type. So like if you are dealing with, you know, a severe betrayal, that's going to be something that's going to unlock some of these six patterns, because the six is called the loyalist, and the six is really looking at, do I have the support and guidance I need? And they're afraid that they don't have support and guidance. So they tend to attach to people who seem very confident. But they're, you know, they're always showing up for the group, and they're hoping that the group will show up for them. So betrayals hurt very much to a six. Then again, the six also interprets a lot of things as betrayal that other types might not interpret that way. So if you're a six, your betrayal is going to be the ultimate thing. But if you're another type and you're dealing with betrayal, you may notice some of these patterns of the six that are really coming to the forefront. And you might go, oh my God, am I six? This whole, like, I thought I was this other type this whole time. Am I actually this? Ah, crisis. And it's just sort of these things that we have to unpack, because these patterns kind of cluster around the fears. So when that particular fear is very relevant to the situation, you might see some of the patterns, but under all of it, your type is still going to be sort of the grounding, you know, anchor for you.
Mm, yeah. Could you just really quickly go through these nine different main types? Could you just really quickly go through them for us, just so we can kind of.
Sure. How about like type, descriptor, and core fear? Does that work?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Perfect.
All right. I need to stretch for this one. This
is a stretch. We're bracing ourselves to work out where we are.
Okay, yes. So type one is called, and the names for it are from the Rizzo-Hudson model, the Reddy model. There are different names, but these are my favorite, so I use them. Yeah. Type one is the reformer. The core fear is being bad or corrupt. Core desire is to be good and have integrity. Mm. Type two is called the helper. That core fear is that they are unworthy of love, and the core desire is to be worthy of love. So the core fear and core desire, two sides of the same coin. Mm-hmm. Type three is the achiever. The achiever's fear is lacking value or being worthless, and their core desire is to have value and worth. Mm-hmm. The type four is called the individualist. They're afraid of not having significance and not being like unique and authentically themselves. And they want to be authentically themselves and understand their significance in the world. Not necessarily like, we don't all need to be, you know, the most famous person, but just, who am I? Why am I here? Kind of thing.
Yeah.
Type five is the investigator. The investigator wants to be competent and capable, and they're afraid of being incompetent and incapable. Type six is the loyalist. They are afraid of being unsupported and without guidance, and they want to have support and guidance. Type seven is the enthusiast, and they are afraid of being trapped in pain and deprivation, and they want to be satisfied. Type eight is the challenger, and they're afraid of being harmed and controlled, and they want autonomy. And then type nine is the peacemaker, and they are afraid of being separated and cut off, and they want to be whole and part of everything and in harmony. So those are the nine types.
Okay. I can see how that's really useful in terms of creating characters for books, because it's nine very separate kind of wounds and things that you could have go wrong.
Yeah, and a lot of the time when you're kind of new to this, you're working with an editor and they're like, well, what does your character want? And you're like, I mean, they want to get to the pizza place. And it's like, no, go deeper. And so this is sort of built-in go deeper. It's like, why do they want to go to the pizza place? Yeah. Because, you know, all of their friends are there and they're an Enneagram 7, the enthusiast, and they're afraid of missing out on all of the fun that's happening there. And, you know, they want the stimulation and they don't want to be trapped in deprivation of pizza and friends, you know? So you can kind of work with it that way too.
Yeah. No, that's brilliant. Cool. Awesome. Okay. So I want you to give us some examples, and I was on your website, so I know that you give them, but some of the things that you do personally and based on your type that kind of help you in your author career, that helping you make decisions and why this is useful and something that people can kind of use for their career and making decisions.
Yeah. So I am a type one, the reformer. And so I want to be a good person. Imagine that. And now just a reminder, everyone probably wants to kind of be a good person. Like just because you're not a one doesn't mean you're a supervillain. But it just means that tends to win out. My fear of being corrupted, of being bad. So the one is very principled. So I have to, in looking at my career, be realistic and say there are going to be some things that may be allowed by terms of service, that sort of thing, but they don't sit right with me. They seem icky. They seem ethically iffy. And I'm just not going to go there. And am I okay with that? Yes. But at the same time, I also want to make sure that I'm not dismissing things out of hand because of the ick factor without looking at that tactic. You know, if I'm like, oh, you know, I don't know, Amazon ads seem sketchy, which I don't think they do. I use them, but, you know, if I was like, oh, because maybe I had a bad experience with someone who was sketchy and really liked Amazon ads or was trying to tell me that I needed to use them, right? So everything kind of gets wrapped up. So I need to stop and say, okay, actually, there's a way I could do this that sits right with me. Mm-hmm. But only then do I really need to proceed with it, because it's just, if I'm going too far outside, you know, I can challenge a little bit and be like, well, I guess it's not really like, it doesn't, like, I don't need to put right or wrong here. It's just a thing. And I could give it a shot. If I'm comfortable with that, I should do that. But as an author, if I do that a lot, it's going to start to wear me down. So as a one, high quality is important to me, like a really high quality of product. And so part of the reason I burned out writing all those cozies was because I was publishing faster than I was allowing myself to actually, like, you know, do multiple revisions and that sort of thing. It was very uncomfortable for me. I hadn't built up that muscle of being okay with releasing something, knowing like, I could have made that much better. The whole like good enough thing is very uncomfortable for ones. So meanwhile, there are other types like threes who are like, it's good enough. Let's go. The whole, you know, minimum viable product concept that was introduced into indie publishing is very much a type three thing because threes are more into efficiency. And so, you know, a lot of people are like, you got to do this minimum viable product. That's the only way to do it. And I tried it and it didn't work for me because that was not my core motivation. So that's kind of where I keep an eye out. Also, when I'm looking at actually just my fiction, I just write a bunch of type one protagonists. And that is just comfortable for me. And they all look different. Because within a single type, you have all kinds of background influences. You have, you know, for each type, there's 9 levels of development. So 3 healthy, 3 average, and 3 unhealthy. So there's a huge variation. And then within those levels, there's all different kinds of patterns that can come up. So there's a huge range there, but the one is just more comfortable for me. So I just decided I'm going to write mostly type one protagonists because when I put them in a situation where they need to make a big decision, it's probably going to be the same one that I make if I was in their position. But if you're writing a character of a different type, what you would do in that situation and what they would do in that situation are probably very different. So that's something to keep an eye out for when you're writing with it. But yeah, so I just was like, yeah, I love themes of right and wrong and the moral gray area. I love digging into the moral gray area. It's very uncomfortable and challenging for me, you know? And so these are the kinds of things that I was writing about anyway. So if someone came along and said, oh, you need to take a little bit of this edginess of right and wrong out of my manuscript, I would tell them to kick rocks. They would not be my editor because that is important to me, right? That's these are the kinds of books that I'm going to keep writing. So it really has helped me learn like what is for me, what is not for me.
That's really cool. That's helpful, actually.
And that's,
And you don't want anyone changing your voice because that would make writing very difficult. Like if someone turned around to me and said tomorrow, I don't like your male leads or whatever, I would be, you know, really like that wouldn't work for me at all. And it would really block me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that when it comes to style, so there's different talk styles for each Enneagram type. And if you adhere to some sort of, you know, like gospel of what a book should read like, there's a good chance that your voice, your talk style is just not like that. I mean, as a one, I'm pretty straight talking in my stories. You know, I'm not super, I don't enjoy descriptions, writing like long detailed descriptions of setting. It's pretty fast paced. I'm a gut center type. So it's like, we're moving. I'm action focused, you know, let's fix this situation. Cause as one, I love fixing things. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the movement of my story. Whereas at Enneagram 9, the peacemaker, these are writers who see the relevance in everything. Right? It's all relevant. I can't leave out details. So they write these really rich, engrossing worlds. And a lot of the times these worlds are very big, like George Lucas is a nine, right? These expansive understandings of the context of the story world. That makes me want to quit thinking of having to do that. So,
I'm
right. So, So if an editor was like, you need to really like think, or if a publisher was telling me to do that, I couldn't do it and enjoy my work.
Just watching your shoulders rise up when you're talking like that. It's like, yeah, make it stop.
Claire, with the work that you've been doing with authors, is there a more common type or types, or is it sort of creativity across the board?
Yeah, it's all across the board. It really is. I mean, there are certain types that are more comfortable working with me and asking for help than others. But when I look out around, you know, at author events and that sort of thing, it really is every single type is represented as I would like for it to be. You know,
absolutely.
I think that any group that really has a type that's underrepresented ends up with problems in that area.
Yeah.
Or a group that devalues a particular type's gifts ends up with big problems in that area.
It makes total sense because you need them all to balance everything out, right? You know, and to challenge and to grow.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's why we work so well, because we are so different.
Exactly.
We're different, right?
Yeah, right.
So the other side of this, and we are all different, I'm agreeing. The other side of this that you talk about is the supercharging side of things. So one side of it is kind of knowing who you are and doing stuff kind of that makes sense for your type. But the other one is actually using that to kind of give you an excitement and energy. And I feel like you've a little bit gone into that in terms of what you were just talking about. But can you just expand on that? Just do that. I was going to, there's a couple of quotes on your website that I have picked that up from, but
Please don't hold me to those quotes. I don't know what they are.
Really true. I'm holding
Great quotes.
Oh, I'm sure they're fabulous. I stick by them 100%. Sure, fine. So you can supercharge by really, once you start like, you know, embracing what you're bringing to it and your style and all of your gifts to it, there are ways to make it really fun. So I think that one of the things you can do is picking themes for your books that really resonate with you. And these are going to be the things that you've been thinking about anyway, that you are like, wait, other people aren't thinking about this all the time? Stuff like fairness, stuff like success, right? Fives like to think of really complex, go into complex systems and simplify them. So you have people like Albert Einstein who love going into complex areas and creating these elegant formulas from it, right? That's how the five brain likes to function, is like these, you know, creating simple out of the complex. The eight thinks a lot about justice and a lot about power. So the other types aren't thinking about it like the eight is. You know, the one sometimes is like, yeah, justice, fairness, I'm in. So that sometimes you see a team up with a one and an eight. But really understanding that it's not like, don't dismiss something that you're interested in. If you're really interested in it, if it keeps coming up again in your life and you just keep, you know, harping on this, like, why doesn't everyone think about this? That's a theme. And that theme is going to sustain you because you can play around with it. You can bring in all these different opinions about it. You can put it into different contexts and it's going to hold your interest. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, stop being like, well, it's a romance, so it needs to be about these particular themes. You can throw any theme into a genre where you don't normally see it, and it spices it up immediately. People, readers will come and they don't know what, they're not thinking about theme. They come in and they start to read the story and they're like, oh my gosh, this is what I needed, but didn't know I needed, right? It, that alone can make the book feel very different while you still stay within the, you know, tropes of the genre. Mm-hmm. So that's one way to do it, bringing your type in as a protagonist, with which most people are doing anyway, mm-hmm. without realizing
yeah.
it,
yeah.
you know, and the fives are like, no one in my story really acts irrational because I'm so logical that it's like, well, you have to solve the problem, right? So all of these characters are like solving things very thoughtfully. And the nine is the peacemaker is having trouble getting the characters to come into conflict with each other because the nines hate conflict, yeah. You know? So, but a nine can be like, okay, I understand this about myself, but I'm going to bring like a peaceful person in and then I'm going to make everyone else be chaotic. And so they have to deal with it, right? So you have something like Harry Potter, who is a nine, and it took a lot of external pressure to get him to sort of take action, yeah. Which is very common with the nine. But you can really put yourself in there, and then you can learn with, when you learn the different types, you can immediately create very diverse sounding characters. Their dialogue's going to sound different. They're going to have different functions mm-hmm. in the story. So if you're like, okay, I just need like some comic relief, maybe bring like a really, you know, fun enthusiast in. Have your enthusiast character. Make sure you have one of each type. You bring the enthusiast in who's like, all right, let's do it. No matter what, you know, how ridiculous the plan is, they're in, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you can play around with that. And it just makes it a lot more fun and interesting when you stop feeling like you must do these things that all the other people in your genre are doing.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And that
freeing,
like you say, keeps the interest from the writer perspective as well, which is a big part of preventing burnout and disillusionment.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. And it just makes it fun to make your story somewhere that challenges you and keeps you engaged.
Yeah.
You know, it's nice to also think of the readers, and that can be really energizing too. Like, oh, they're going to love this. You know, when you're a few books into a series and you kind of have a read on them and you're like, oh, this scene, they're going to talk about this scene, and that can make it really fun to write.
Yeah.
But it can also just be like, ooh, I wonder if I can get away with this. Let's see. Yeah. You know, that can be that sort of mischievous sense, or the just, oh, like this is the safe place for me to actually have a character express these feelings that I don't feel like I get to express.
Yeah.
Right. And that can really connect you to the manuscript as well.
Yeah.
So when would you recommend, when people start, obviously we're going to recommend your books and your website, which has got some great information at ffsmedia.com, but is there a particular site that they could start doing a test, or do you need to talk to somebody through it or read a book? Like, what, how would you start the process of understanding your Enneagram?
Any of those are fine to start. It can be a bit of a process, so I think that's the most important thing to remember, is that it can be a process. The tests aren't 100% correct. Like, if we're really going to get into the technical on it, there's the two paid tests that you generally see, which is the WEPS test and the READY test. They're about $15 a piece, and they are 50 to 60% accurate on your top score being your type. Mm-hmm. So only 50 to 60%. That's not a great accuracy. They're about 90% accurate on your type being in the top three scores.
Right.
So both of those will give you a report with your top three scores listed and a report on each of those. So you can read about your top three scores. And then it's up to you to kind of be like, which one is more like me, and narrow it down. So you can start with the test. You can also start reading just by reading about them. I have brief descriptions in my Reclaim Your Author Career book. There are descriptions all over the internet for it. And I find that it's helpful to kind of read different sources because they're going to be focusing on different aspects of it. And you can kind of triangulate what it is and if it's you. So sometimes reading about a your type from one source, it's just not going to resonate. Maybe that the person writing it just doesn't know much about that type or just doesn't really have a clear connection to themselves to it. While if you read about it another source, it may be like, oh, duh, yeah, that's definitely it. So that's a place to start. There are some books, The Essential Enneagram. This is a 100-page book. It's very short. It's like a field guide to Enneagram. This is The Essential Enneagram by David Daniels and Virginia Price. If you just want sort of a pocket guide, this is really good for characters as well, because it's just going to give you kind of a stat sheet on the different types. But in the back, it also has some like growth, you know, suggestions, but it also has differentiating questions. So if you don't know if you're a two or a seven, it'll give you like a a paragraph here on like the difference between the two and the seven. So it can kind of help you in that way. That's definitely one I would recommend. And you can also just come see me. I occasionally do. If you sign up for my list at ffs.media/join, I occasionally do free type calls where I'll do an hour on each type. And so you can come if you're like, I want to learn about this type because I'm writing it, or I think these two might be, my type might be one of these two, but I'm not sure. You can come ask me your questions. You can come listen to it. Those are really fun because I will pull some people up onto stage, right? It's on Zoom, but onto stage, who are that type, and I'll ask them questions and you can listen to how they respond. That's kind of the same, kind of different. And it's really a good time doing that. So yeah, I have resources if you just make sure that you're signed up for my list. I let people know about it. And then I constantly send out stuff about Enneagram and Enneagram development and characters through my list. It's, I should probably put it behind a paywall, but I don't.
Yeah. Life's short sometimes, right? There's so many things you can do. The other thing I think this is a great tool for personally, because I'm all about learning about how what makes people tick, and I love this, which drives some of the girls here to distraction, but
no judgment here.
I do overthink it, but I also think it's a way of understanding. So I'm going to move into talking about the writing environment now, particularly in the self-publishing world. Obviously the topic of the moment is AI, pros, cons, all the rest of it. And without digging into that, but it helps me understand that when people react in a way, whatever way they react, it's how different they are, like how two people can see the same thing. And it doesn't even have to be AI. It can be a cover model, or it can be a title, or it can be a genre. And because I think there's a danger that we think, oh, we're all self-publishers, so we're all on the kind of that we think the same, which clearly it isn't happening. And it doesn't make anybody bad just because they think a different way. I'm all about the peace and the love and everybody understanding. That's what I'm all about. But I think it helps to, for me, it helps because sometimes I get very upset sometimes that there's strong opinions that are very black and white and all I see is shades of grey. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about using your Enneagram type to kind of deal with the slings and the arrows of self-publishing.
First of all, slings and arrows in self-publishing, never heard of it.
It's all peace, love, and rainbows.
I mean, anytime, and we've seen this in the industry multiple times with KU, with all these different things that come around that change the industry, what you see is it's like just the fear gets kicked up like a bunch of dust, right? And it's just in the air. And so, yeah, I think that understanding the different kinds of fear, right? One thing like AI is going to be scary in 9 different ways with the Enneagram.
Good point.
And so when we get scared, what happens when we get scared is we lose our self-awareness, right? The different part of our brain comes to the forefront, right? The very reactive primitive part of our brain. And so our self-awareness, our mindfulness, our ability to pause between stimulus and response decreases.
Yeah.
And when it decreases, what happens is we actually go down those levels of development that I mentioned, the 9 levels of development. So it's a constant, we're moving through them constantly. But things that scare us put us down there. So we have less self-awareness and we're reacting more out of a knee-jerk reaction of fear. And so weird things start to happen. And this happens to all of us. We all get a little weird when we're scared. And certain things scare us that don't scare other people and vice versa. So I think that understanding that can be really helpful if you're, first of all, nothing's resolved on the internet. So I think that's important to remember, right? But when you're one-on-one with someone, if you can understand the fear that it's stirring up in them, it's much easier to meet them there and help them relax and see, because when we're afraid, we don't see possibilities. Yeah. We only see dangers. And so really helping people kind of start to see the possibilities while not dismissing the fears and the you know, possible problems in the future. We want to get ourselves into those higher levels because that's where we have things like wisdom. We have things like courage. We have, you know, our creative thinking. All of that takes place in those higher levels when we work on our self-awareness and we work on these mindfulness practices that I describe a lot in Sustain Your Author Career. It's basically like, here's how we keep from freaking out. and so, you know.
We only need that, right?
We do. Myself included. I only write it when I'm writing from my, you know, higher place. And then I freak out about something and, you know, my husband talks me down. He's a hostage negotiator, so he's good at that. But I know I give him lots of practice, you know, that's all I gotta say. It's, a lot of my expenses should just be like professional development for him. But
seems fair.
So it's really about kind of understanding. For me, it's helped me get out of my own sort of black and white thinking of like, ooh, this is a threat, this is bad, you know, condemn, right? That's the one pattern, which is very unflattering of me to even talk about, you know, to say that I have that impulse. But it's true that I have that impulse, and in recognizing that, I become more aware of it, and I'm less likely to fall into that, right? Yeah. So noticing when my body is telling me condemn, and being like, nah, I think we're good. I think we're fine. I think I just need a glass of water and a snack, you know?
So yourself down off the ledge.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And saying, what am I not seeing here? Right. That's a really important question. What am I not seeing here? That can unlock a lot because it tells your brain that there are things that you're not seeing, right? It reminds you that you aren't you don't have the keenest vision of everyone out there. Right. And maybe you're missing something. Maybe other people have a point. So that can kind of open your ability to see things from other people's perspectives. And just because you can see and understand where they're coming from doesn't mean that you have to be cool with it. But it can really help you feel less reactive when you understand it. So in learning this, I've learned so much compassion for people. Just because I understand that it's not that they don't want to do the right thing. They're just doing something completely different. They're functioning on a different framing. And what they're doing strikes me as the wrong thing. And like, also, who am I? I'm not the judge and jury here, you know, like maybe it's fine. Maybe they're, you know, maybe I just need to let them do their thing. So I think that it can really help with that. But when you look at something like AI, I think it really helps to decode what a specific person is really like talking about when they're talking about their fear or even the possibilities. So the possibilities play more to the desire, right? This sort of desire of the type that we don't necessarily recognize. So like maybe someone's desire is, you know, maybe they're a 6 and they're like, oh, this is actually a great place for support and guidance. Maybe this can help support me, right? And they're so desperate for that support that they're like, yes, AI, like save me. You're my only hope, right? At the same time, you're probably going to see a lot of 6s who are like, this is a threat, kill it, you know? So it really, you're going to see both types come down on both sides of it.
Yeah.
Or every type come down on both sides of it in varying degrees. And so it's not like, you know, all type 1s think this about it, all type 3s take this approach, that sort of thing. For some 3s, it's really threatening because it feels like competition. So the 3 is the achiever and they're trying to achieve all these things. And they're like, oh, well now someone who's good at this, maybe they don't feel like they're good at it. Like they really understand how to use AI, in which case someone who did could out-achieve them. So then it would feel like a threat. But if they understand how to use it and they're like, I love this, this is really fun, then it could be like, you know, ding, ding. Yes, this is the ticket to achieve the most that I've ever achieved. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think that it's a tool and people are responding to it in a bunch of different ways because of their fear and desire.
Mm. I think that's great. And thank you for pointing out, because it hadn't occurred to me that you can, the same type can respond in those two different ways or more ways. But like, yeah, because I had sort of like, oh, the ones or the two, like, so that's on me, right? I'm trying to divide everybody up into nine boxes, but it's really not. So that was a great reminder. Thank you.
So we talked a little bit about earlier that, well, I can't remember we talked about it, but about the Enneagram and the Clifton Strengths. And Clifton Strengths is something that a lot of people know about as well. Do they work together? Are they completely opposite ends of the spectrum? Can you sort of?
Yeah, they work together. Becca Simon and I chat a lot about this, and we don't have to like battle it out in the octagon. Like, we're on the same page.
Yeah.
We,
you know, I was hoping for like a, you know,
age fighting.
One corner of the Enneagram, the other corner of the Strengths.
Signs and all sorts.
Yeah, I was thinking Las Vegas, ring. Oh, man.
I know. I do love a good fight, but unfortunately, there's just none to be had here. So they work really well together. Dan Wood actually described this. Becca and I were chatting with him about this for probably a couple of days over a conference. And he finally was like, well, it's kind of like Enneagram is the operating system and Strengths are the apps. And I'm like, yes. Ooh, but yeah. Becca and I was like, yeah, how did you come up with that? We've been struggling to describe that. But yeah, so it really is like, you know, you're going to have a strength. Let's just take a strength. I'll say strategic, because a lot of indie authors have high strategic. It's my number one strength. But so you have this strategic strength and it kind of functions a certain way. But what it's trying to accomplish is going to be based off your motivation. Mm. So this best seeking of the strategic, I want to find the best way to do this. Well, for a one, that's going to look like the, you know, most, that like the best for everyone kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, let's improve things. What's the best way to like fix this situation and improve it? For a three, the best is going to be like, what's the most effective way to do this? What's the most efficient way to do this? That's really where the focus is going to be with that strategic. With a nine, it may be the peacemaker. That's going to be something like, how do I do this while causing the least amount of conflict? What's the most harmonious way to go about doing this? So that's what the best seeking is going to be for strategic, right? So the Enneagram type really filters through the strengths and sort of gives them purpose and a mission of like, how are you using these strengths? To what end are you using your strengths? So that's why, you know, two people who have, you know, four of the five same top strengths can function very differently because they are different Enneagram types. And people of the same Enneagram type can function very differently because they have vastly different strengths. So that adds a lot of variety, a lot of possibility there.
Mm. It makes total sense.
It does make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
totally.
Oh gosh, I can see I'm going to be doing my Enneagram test after the podcast.
Remembering that it's the top three that you're looking at to default to through rather than the number, you know, chances.
I find that the tests are good for ruling out a couple types and then you can kind of, you know, look at your main ones and just read and think about your life. You want to make sure you're looking at the totality of your life, not just right now. The totality of your life, if you're still stumped, think about your early 20s or like the, you know, 5 to 7 years after you left your family of origin, because you're out from their influence and you have the least amount of self-awareness you'll ever have in your life during those years. So your patterns are very pronounced.
Yeah.
So that's really where you can start to look for some of the answers.
It's uncomfortably true, Claire. Thank you for pointing that out. Ouch.
I've always thought, oh, I wish I'd known a lot of this stuff when I was in my 20s. But actually, it's true for all of us in our 20s. We were roaming around at will with no idea.
No, just out there, just like loose, say. Like,
hello world, here I come. Clueless.
Yep.
But you think you know everything, right?
Just autopilot. Yep, just all the patterns, just go full force. Yeah,
and
no thinking.
I
just
got into a plane and traveled overseas straight away for 2 years. And I was like, just left out in the world or without my family.
There you go. Yeah, there's a lot of that in the early 20s.
I just made my own family.
So you've got your book Reclaim Your Author Career, but you've also got a second one that you've actually done a Kickstarter for. So I'm really curious about that, how that went and what why you decided to do Kickstarter and how, all about it. Do tell.
Well, yes. So I ran a Kickstarter for Reclaim Your Author Career back in 2022. Because I was like, well, this is my first book in this. Like, I've been doing the consulting and coaching, but I was like, this is my first book. We'll just launch it with all of the stuff that I offer because that'll just be easy. We'll do that one and done. I'm kind of a spurt energy kind of person. I like to do things real hard for a little bit and then disappear, and then come back and do things really hard, then disappear. That's kind of my flow. So Kickstarter was really good for that. It went really well. That one raised a whole lot of money and it got me a lot of new cool clients that I got to work with. So I was like, why would I not do that again? Mm. So with my second book, Sustain Your Author Career, that builds on Reclaim Your Author Career. It can stand alone, but it also, I think they're a nice companion to each other. I decided to just do another Kickstarter. So I launched it as we're recording this. I don't know when it releases, but as we're recording it, it was like 2 days ago. So it funded rather quickly and we're just letting it ride. And, you know, I'll keep talking about it and we'll see who shows up, but I'm already really happy with it. You know, it hit its funding goal. And so I try not to get too greedy, you know, it's like great. A couple hundred people have found it. So
what was your funding goal?
Awesome. 5,000.
Because I have heard, and I don't know if this is, but the strategy for Kickstarter is to sort of have a fairly low goal so that you fund quickly and then have the push goals.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I could have done that. I just did the cost of the production for it was about $5,000 of like editing and cover and all of that. So I was like, let's just see if we can cover these costs. And that was nice.
You're moving forward. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Just a side question, how do you approach the writing of nonfiction compared to your fiction, Claire? Is it a big difference for you? Is it easier, harder, pulling teeth?
Yeah, it is. After my first one came out, I was like, never doing that again. That is too hard. I'm going back to my made-up stories. And it's scarier, I think, to publish nonfiction, especially, you know, it's challenging, in the climate we're in right now to tell people like, we're going to be fine. Like the industry is going to be changing, but like, you can be fine. You can feel like I'm fine. I can do this. I have the tools. Some people aren't open to receiving that right now. So that is a little bit scary. I don't know why it's scarier than like publishing my comedy series about God's daughter in Texas. Like that was kind of scary too.
Wow.
I'm like, we're like 5 years away from me having to leave this state completely.
It's a brave
come to New Zealand. We'll have you.
Yeah. I would love to. Yes. I'll be a refugee. I'll get that status. It's a way different challenge. I've written so much fiction. It's like, yeah, of course fiction's going to be easier. I've done it a bunch more times.
Yeah.
And then the nonfiction, it's just, you know, I have been a teacher before, so that role is a little bit more familiar, but oh man, I tried not to be a teacher so many times. I kept trying not to be a teacher and then I kept teaching and I was like, oh, and then I had a psychic tell me that I had blue teacher energy and I was like, no,
I don't want that.
Here I am.
Give it back.
I know. Here I am. It's sort of, you know, helping people, but I like just giving people information and letting them kind of learn on their own and discover. And it's just a fun process. And I just kind of get to be here like, yeah, you did it. That was hard. You did it. Yeah. So that is fun, but it's difficult. And I put a lot more pressure on myself with the nonfiction.
Yeah.
I don't want to be wrong. That's part of my type. Yeah, I don't want to be wrong.
Yeah.
Oh, that's hard.
No one likes being wrong, I'll be honest.
I was
going to
say, surely.
Yeah, yeah.
Surely there's no one that likes being wrong. And so the second one, you just went, oh, I must have been wrong the first time, and I'm going to do it.
I'm going to write
it. Yeah, completely. Yeah, this is the apology book, actually. No. So the first one is, Reclaim Your Author Career is more about learning how you can use your type to kind of structure. So we look at your values, the values that you have. Those are kind of, we do these concentric circles. So the biggest one is the values, and everything wants, you want everything to fall within your type's values and your personal values. And then we go down into, you know, the persona. So what part of you are you going, you know, a genuine, authentic part of you, are you going to share, and what do you keep for yourself? You know, so we talk a little bit about that. And a lot of the times people don't actually realize what they have to offer their fans because it's not like they've seen other people offering. So we do a little work around that. So you can see like what gifts you're bringing that you may not be aware of bringing. And then we look at themes that work for you. We look at the protagonist. So that's the structure of the first book, is kind of getting it's like a new structure paradigm for how you're looking at your career. Sustain Your Author Career is for, you've kind of figured this out, maybe a little bit, you kind of have it, but things are changing all of the time in the industry. How do you stay aligned when things aren't working that used to work? How do you stay, you know, in yourself and just in your body and in your heart? How do you stay connected to your head and your heart and your body when things aren't working, or when you feel blocked and just can't connect to your manuscript? So we do a lot of troubleshooting in that. So like if you're blocked, we talk about, it could be that you need rest, and we are very, very uninformed about what rest actually looks like. It's very rarely sitting on the couch and watching Netflix. Mm-hmm. It often looks very active, right? Yeah. Resting. And so we look into that. We look at, you know, sort of these diagnostic tools that I like to help authors with, like, is it my head that's tired? Is it my heart that's tired? Is it my body that's tired? Because we haven't really been taught to look at that, right? Maybe we've been overusing our heart. And so going and getting in our body with a good workout is a way to kind of take the stress off of that and like use other parts of ourselves, you know? So we talk a lot about that. We talk about this one is really gonna make me some enemies, but getting clear on what we can and can't control in this industry, which is what we can control, us, our decisions, what we want to do, how we go about doing things, what we can't control, everything else, including the results and the outcomes. And so it's really easy, if we're not bringing mindfulness to that, to subconsciously expect that we can control the results. Mm-hmm. And that can get us very blocked and very down on ourselves and very demotivated. So that's the kind of stuff that this is looking at, is really just, it's like a maintenance guide for building the sustainable author. Cause you can't have a sustainable author career if you are not sustainable. So that's really what this is focusing on.
It's very true. And so often we talk, or we think about the author bits, as in the production and the publishing and the strategy, but very, we're not often considering the engine that's producing those things, right?
Yes. And that engine runs out of fuel if you don't fill it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Very Some days true. You're just like, oh, I'm so tired of it all, you know, aren't you? Mm-hmm. And then the next day you feel great. Oh, you're on top of it.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa. Yeah. Right. What happened there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, there's like things we can do to speed that process along and just like be able to tell, am I like, do I need a break from this? Or is there something else that I can quickly tune into, clear that sort of block and reconnect to the manuscript? Because sometimes it's just getting connected to the words each day can be a struggle. But there's always reasons behind it. And we explore those. And there's an answer. And when you get to that, sometimes it's like, boom, as soon as you see the answer, the problem goes away. Wow. Sometimes you see the answer and the problem doesn't go away, but you now have a path to proactively work on it.
Mm-hmm. That's brilliant. Awesome. I really like that, separating the three areas, the mind, the body, and the heart. That's awesome. Awesome. So I think we're coming up to the end of our time together with you, Claire. It's been amazing. But is there just one little bit of the nugget of gold that you'd like to leave our listeners with, just something that you'd like them to take away from all the work that you
do? We know it's all been gold, but
fool's gold. I think that, you know, the best thing you can do is get to know yourself in this and get to know what works for you. Because the more you get to know yourself, the less likely someone will reel you in with another thing that takes you off the path that you're supposed to be walking. And we all are connected to the truth. But there's a lot of razzle dazzle that wants to, you know, sort of obscure it from us. So I think when, you know, learning to recognize the truth, feel it in your body, feel it in your heart, you know, it just clicks in your mind, whichever one you're the strongest connected to, you can kind of feel it there. And, you know, starting to value that. I think that's really like how we keep going, how we do this long-term, and how every new wave of, you know, panic, that we don't have to ride it. You know, we can just keep going. It doesn't have to affect us in that way.
That's very cool. Good advice. So if someone has listened to this and immediately wants to go and buy all your books and do all your courses, where's the best place to go?
FFS.media is my website. And so that has all my courses. It has, if you want to do one-on-one with me, I have, you know, a retreat coming up in October. So there's all that. My books are there. My fiction's there as well, if you are feeling dangerous. And so yeah, everything there. And you can also, you know, contact me through the website and we can chat. If you're like, I don't know where to start, that's fine. You don't have to know everything. You can just know a person who knows it. And I can help you with that. So
awesome. That's fantastic. And Sha, where can we be found?
We can be found at sparklesspodcast.com. We're on YouTube and we are on Instagram and we are on Patreon at Sparkles Podcast if you'd like to come along and buy us a coffee and support the show.
Awesome. Brilliant. And thank you, Claire. And thank you to all of our listeners for listening to another episode of the Spa Girls Podcast. We'll be back again next week. But for now, farewell.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.